Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 58, and I'm your host, Nick Ortigo. Mental health will become part of the high school curriculum in Virginia, and should we be concerned that college tuition is becoming a punchline? Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, how video games may be improving the way our students learn. Hello, everybody. Nick Ortigo here, and I'm joined by teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt, and Russ has the day off today. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
How's the class coming? We inching along? Is it done now? Can we say that?
Well, no, it's not done, but it looks so much better. It feels like my classroom now.
Okay, that's good. So what's not done about it? Is it like still messy?
Well, all the furniture has been moved out. Every teacher knows that at the end of the school year, you have to pack up all your stuff, and you can't leave anything on any shelves or surfaces or tables. And then they come and move every bit of furniture out of your room and strip and wax the floors, and then they move it all back in. So
but when does that happen?
Furniture.
I mean, we're getting close, aren't we? We're about a month, less than a month.
I report in 2.5 weeks.
Okay, yeah.
So I'm sure the furniture will be moved back in. But I mean, I've been, you know, like I said, painting a mural and just kind of going through stuff that was on the shelves and in the closet.
Right.
But it does look better.
I know Russ is out today. He's been working a conference with superintendents. I was there with him earlier this week, and it was a good conference. It was, you forget the impact that they have with all the superintendents around the state. So I had the opportunity to interview a lot of superintendents and teachers and stuff that use their product, and they were glowing with great stuff to say about them. So it was a neat conference to see all that. Enough of the small talk, Lissa. Why don't you go ahead and we'll jump into the teacher's lounge.
I was reading that Virginia is now they're making it mandatory for 9th and 10th grade students to have mental health courses.
This seems to make sense.
Yes, right? Absolutely. And it's taught, I taught health one semester, middle school health. And there is a small section in the curriculum for basic, I can't remember what it was called, but health something 101, I don't know. And there was a section on there about mental health and changes and kind of awareness of maybe some mental disorders and things that can develop through adolescence. And then, of course, drugs and alcohol and all that goes into health. But they are requiring it that they said Virginia feels like that 9th and 10th grade students are the appropriate age to learn about suicide risk and disorders, depression.
Yeah,
and,
you know, like when you and I were young, I think we all had to deal with the, you know, the drugs and the alcohol and the peer pressure. Mm-hmm. But it's different now. I can't imagine being a teenager right
now.
We've talked a little bit about this before, but the social media, how it follows you home, how people are more callous in social media than they would be face to face.
Right. And also, you know, like I think back on friends that I knew, you know, had some, you know, they maybe weren't making great choices, or maybe they had some, you know, small disorders, and it was super, super quiet, but it's not quiet anymore. So if somebody really is kind of struggling, or if they're abusing themselves in some way, whether it be with drugs or bulimia or anorexia, it's not as quiet. It's a little more widely known. Mm-hmm. It's almost like everybody can see it, whether it's through their social media posts or whatever. And so I think this course is designed to help them navigate through getting someone else help, getting themselves help, recognizing that they need help. And of course, I think a lot of it is with suicide prevention and also with anger.
I don't have the any statistical data in front of me, but when I was working in a newsroom for several years, it seemed like teen suicides were on the rise.
Well, the CDC out of Atlanta says that in the last 2 years, it has risen 30%.
Right.
That's shocking. That is, yeah. And so I do think that's part of why that this is, you know, it's going to be taught through physical education, which normally you get for a whole Carnegie unit, a fraction of that is physical education and a fraction of that is health. So they're putting this right in there with that for mandatory for 9th and 10th graders in Virginia. So
did you say they were the second state to do this?
Second. And I tried to find who the first state is.
Right. I'm sure somebody listening may know. But so is there any controversy around this? Does anyone I can't think of a reason for someone to say, no, we shouldn't.
No,
we shouldn't
I don't think that there's going to be controversy. I think it just sometimes it takes somebody saying, this is what we're going to do. This is mandatory. I know that a lot of states teach that within health, maybe in middle school, maybe they brush over it.
Right.
But I think it's important that someone is saying, no, it's a requirement now.
Right.
And it's for 9th and 10th grade, like so that you know that anybody that's gone through those schools in 9th and 10th grade has a little bit, you know, maybe a few tools under their belt as far as to help each other or help themselves. And also, I should say that the article that I read went on to say that they're doing it also across the board with teachers. They're right. requiring a lot of professional development for mental disorder. So that can be obviously for suicide prevention and to help students that seem at risk in that way, but also students that seem at risk dealing with severe anger and depression mm-hmm. that can lead to bigger outcomes too.
A lot of people may not know this, but most media agencies have a policy where if there's a suicide, unless it happened in a public place, so you have to report it, you would report it. Or if it was somebody who was the mayor or somebody who's really well known in the community, then you typically report that. But other than that, you don't because you worry about copycats. And it's just kind of the rule right. and the ethics that, you know, news stations don't really go on the news and say there was a teen at such and such high school who committed suicide. Right. I always felt kind of guilty about that too, because it's like, why are we not talking about this? And what we did as a newsroom is we did cover it. We would, after the fact, not cover the actual event, but we would do bigger stories about suicide and suicide prevention. And we mm-hmm. would actually talk to parents who had to deal with this. But this is good. This is like, we need to have the conversation. And I applaud any school that, you know, is actually going to have a course where they can talk to kids about it.
Right. And it does have to be talked about. I mean, and I get it that sometimes people don't want to talk about it at the time because you don't want to call attention to it. And then someone else that's struggling thinks, wow, I want that attention too.
Right.
So I get that there, maybe that's why there's sometimes distance, but I think awareness, you know, being proactive with students, teachers, administrators, you know, programs, what programs are out there, I think that's a good start. And I'm sure we'll see that. You know, a lot of times, I know we've said before that a lot of times when a state does something with their curriculum, then you see it be adopted with the curriculums all through the United States. So.
Right. Well, good stuff. Well done, Virginia. Switching gears a little bit, on a lighter note, I'm going to play something for you, okay? And just kind of listen to it, and then I'll explain what you're listening to.
Michael Torpy, my show Paid Off is the only game show working to end the student debt crisis. We asked 100 recent college graduates, what is the last thing you'd want your parents to find in your dorm room? Tierra.
Use condom.
Whoa. Top spot again, Tierra! As an architecture major, if you could build a structure that would represent your student debt, what would it be?
It'd be a giant middle finger.
Woo! Paid Off series premiere July 10th. The more you know, the less you owe.
So I don't play that to promote the show, you know, but it is. It's on True TV, and that's a trailer for a real game show that's coming out. And just listening to it, it almost sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit.
It does.
You know, but this is real life.
It's like real life.
This somebody came up with the idea of we're going to do a game show where we pay off people's student debt
because that's such a big issue. So let's do it. Yeah.
And so part of me is like, all right, well, we shouldn't be having fun with this because this right. seriously is a crisis. But another part of me is like, well, this is where we are. Mm-hmm. How did we get here?
And to be fair, you know, everybody. There's some of the greatest, you know, professions, doctors, attorneys, they have huge amounts of student loan debt.
Right.
So it affects a lot of people.
Yeah, it's not just, you know, somebody with an English degree.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So this is something that anybody can relate to.
Right.
And I mean, that's a funny concept. Instead of just giving you $1 million, you know, it's going to go towards your debt. And that's interesting and funny the way that they did that, because it's no different than giving someone.
Maybe the tax implications wouldn't be the same either.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, there's plenty of game shows where you win $25,000. So right. Instead, they're saying, well, you're going to win $25,000 for your student debt, which is it's a neat way to appeal to a lot of people that are like, yeah, I want to go on that show.
I guess. But at the end of the day, you know, it's like we're doing this. How sustainable is our higher education model knowing that we're doing this?
Yeah. I mean, I do think that it's too expensive. And I think when you look at what you pay, not just for the courses, but for room and board and all, you know, all of that, books, you know, I do think that it's getting to, I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know how sometimes people are like, they don't want to talk about something that they know is overpriced, you know, like maybe a jacket that they wear and they wanted the jacket and they bought the jacket, but then they don't really want to talk too much about the jacket because everybody knows how much that jacket costs.
Right.
So I feel like our college is, you know, the university, the fees and everything. It's like when you know, like, gosh, you know, they way overpaid for that college, whereas some colleges are maybe not so over the top and some are. So I think, I guess I feel like there's starting to be a trend where it's a little much of a, it's a little, I guess, to be cool, to use the word extra. So certain price tags on certain universities for just a liberal arts degree is a little extra.
I'll try to speak. I'm not in higher education, but I've interviewed a lot of folks in higher education, and typically they're like, well, you know, the state's cutting back on our money, and we're having to make up for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the truth is, and I'm not here to debate that. But I just think there is a tipping point, and it almost starts to feel like we're getting really close.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, like, I feel the same way. It's getting to where I, instead of just always being like, no, college is important. No, you have to have a college degree. I still feel that way.
Right.
But there are definitely universities that are popping up in my mind that I'm thinking, hey, I have to go to that one. That's a little extra.
Do you know who John Mulaney is?
No.
I think he is probably the most brilliant comedian out right now.
Like, I probably know his face.
He is a former writer of Saturday Night Live. He's actually now gone on tour and he's hosted Saturday Night Live. Like, he's a big comedian now. He does a bit about the price of college and that he spent, I think, $120,000 on college.
I just got a letter from my college, which was fun because mail, you know? So I open up the letter and they said, hey, John, it's college. You remember? I say, yes, of course. And then they said, how did they phrase it? Then they said, give us some money as a gift. We want a gift, but only if it's money. I found this peculiar. Because you see, what had happened, New York, was that when I was a student, you see, I had paid them a tuition money. Every semester, two semesters a year, for 4 years. I don't remember exactly what it was, but rounding up, back in 1999 dollars, it was about $15,000 a semester, okay, two semesters a year for 4 years. So it was about $30,000 a year for 4 years. So it was about $120,000, okay? So roughly speaking, I gave my college about $120,000, okay? So you might say that I already gave them $120,000, and now you have the audacity to ask me for more money? What kind of a cokehead relative? What kind of a cokehead relative is my college? You spent it already!
Anyhow, and look, I don't want to sound like we're beating up on institutions of higher learning. They are phenomenal, get incredible degrees. But this is what people are laughing about.
Right. And there was there was a show, I want to say it was on TLC, and it was going to follow like 10 students who went to college. And it was, from the commercials, I remember thinking it was going to highlight how, you know, the sea of mediocrity out there and how they didn't feel like they got what they paid for. And then it was going to like follow, I think, other people that didn't go to college and work their way up through an industry. You know, I do think that obviously there are certain career paths that you want to take that you absolutely need to go to college for sure. But I do think at some point the colleges have got to stop and really audit their programs and their professors,
right,
and make sure that what they're doing is current and going to transfer into today's global society, you know, because I think that, like, some of the things, even though I was an education major, I know that a lot of the things that I had to do that took an extreme amount of time to prepare for my courses in college didn't help me even in the elementary classroom.
Right.
And I was in, I don't mean even in the elementary classroom. It's just, I know when you think about a teacher going to school to learn to be a teacher, you're thinking that they're getting everything, that they're not wasting any time. They're efficient and learning what they need to learn.
You probably could have learned a lot on the job, is kind of what
I could have learned a lot on the job, but I also could have, instead of creating these silly projects that took endless amounts of time and paper and imagination that aren't real work. There were none of them I've used.
Felt like busy work.
Right. Yes.
You know, colleges are made up of schools. And some schools, whether it be the school for nursing or the school for education or so forth on a college campus, are better than others. They're not all equal. And I think it's important for students who are going into the university to figure out, it's hard to know what you're going to do when you're 18.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do, find the college that has the best school for what you want to do. And then you're going to get your $120,000 worth. But if you just kind of go to a school and go, oh yeah, they do that, but do they do it well?
And, you know, in the art aspect, which this, you know, you may want to cut all of this, but in the art aspect, there are so many people that I teach as adults, you know, just a one-night art class, you know, where I'm teaching how to use certain medium and things. And they'll mention towards the end of class, they'll say, you know, thank you so much for showing me how to do this. I've always wanted to know how to do this. And it's just so nice to have someone show you. You know, I took art, or I minored in art, or I majored in art at a university. And I am not kidding you, Nick, 5 out of 6 people say, and I was told that I would never be an artist, or I was told that...
Right.
You know, or no one showed me, or I was made fun of or made to feel less. And I too, you know, Lissa here, I was told that I would never really be an artist. And, you know, and I am an artist of sorts. And so I, as an adult, I don't like to say I'm an artist. I'll say I teach art.
Right.
And I think the reason I don't like to say that is because I had someone tell me I wouldn't be one.
Yeah.
And that person was a professor.
That you were paying $100,000
And he said it in front of the class.
Yeah.
And he didn't just say it to me. He said it to 3 of us and said that we wouldn't probably, you know, might want to consider changing our major.
Well, let's go. Let's call him one day. Can we do that? Like, we just randomly call him?
I think I've been given the award locally for
Artist
of the Year.
Should have gotten his
phone
number.
Which is a silly award, but still.
That would have been interesting podcasting material.
But I went to a certain place and had that experience. But then there are people that I've met through these little adjunct art courses that went to schools in other states and other places, and they had the same experience. And then you think, okay, well, if that's happening in the art area of universities where there's a professor kind of, you know, wielding his power and making you feel smaller, he or she, then it's probably happening in language, you know, majors. It's probably happening in, you know, communication majors. If you'll never make it in the marketing world. And, you know, and then it's like, well, wait, is that what we paid all that money to go there and be beat down? Because it didn't change my course. I am an artist still.
Right.
So, you know, but what if it had?
Right. I want to give John Mulaney his credit. If you liked what he was talking about there and you want to hear more, you can catch him on Netflix. He's got 2 different shows on there. They're really funny. Is some coarse language, though, just as a heads up. Are you ready for the bright idea, Alyssa?
Yes.
We are talking to Kim Bevel, who we interviewed last week, and we talked about the exercise and the brain and the effects it has. Now we're talking about video games and the brain and the effects that it has.
Oh, this is big right now with Fortnite and everything.
They're not all negative, which is going to tell you. So
I'm sorry, this just in. Nick is a gamer.
I really don't play that much, but I do. I do enjoy watching my kids play now, and it's probably my fault that they play. So we'll leave it at that. Uh, Our guest in today's Bright Ideas segment was a high school history and psychology teacher for 14 years before diving into the world of neuroscience. Kim Bevel's company, which you can find at kimbevel.com, now helps train educators to understand how the brain works so educators can get better results in the classroom. Kim was a guest on last week's show where we talked about exercise in the brain. This week, we're focusing on the effects of Hollywood and video games. Kim, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back. I like talking about this topic. And hate it.
This one's interesting to me because I grew up in the 90s, I guess is when I was in high school, and that's when the chorus of video games are melting your brain was very strong. It was, you know, video games were somewhat of a new thing, and it was just kind of discouraged to do that. And I want to get your take on that topic.
Well, I said earlier, honestly, it's my favorite topic, and it's the topic I hate discussing. And that is because my bias is going to come out in it. And I'll just start by telling you, I am not a gamer. And I can remember when the original Atari came out, I can remember the oldest games like Pong. And that dates me a lot. But the truth is that somewhere in my career, I noticed that there were so many students who loved these things and people in the world who just couldn't get enough of them. I thought there's got to be something to this. So I began pouring into it. I thought there has to be some kind of a principle in video games, in computer games, and in movies, quite frankly, Hollywood and television. If everybody loves this stuff, I thought, I'm going to go find out what it is, steal it, and bring it into my curriculum so that I can try to duplicate some of this fever in my classroom. So what we understand about video games is what most people expect. Most teachers and parents want or are probably listening right now to hear about how awful it is so they can go and stop someone they care about from playing them. And the truth is that they are creepy, like we think. Within 30 seconds of watching a video or within watching TV, the frontal cortex, our EEGs, which is our electricity, that's our wave, that's activity in your frontal cortex. It goes from beta state, which is where you're spending most of your day in activity. It goes from beta state into alpha state. Well, what we know about alpha state is it's a relaxation state and is a place where we're highly suggestible. That when you're in alpha, your brain is almost like on receive mode, that I'm going to listen to what you say.
Like we're being hypnotized in a way, but not quite that severe.
You can use hypnotized. I think it works just fine because during hypnosis, people go into a relaxation state. And during hypnosis, people can potentially be suggested so that they're willing to listen to and become highly influential. And there's a lot of evidence that says the alpha state allows you to physiologically just hit a relaxation and help with your immune system. And it might help to explain why some people do display I'll call it an addiction to television. The addiction with video games is very well researched, that 1 in 5 people who play a video game is going to become addicted to video game play. And that's going to impact the dopamine centers. So not just the electrical impulse in your brain, but literally your nucleus accumbens and the reward center of your brain.
So is it bad? Is it okay to be in that alpha stage for a long period of time?
More important than the alpha stage, let's switch into the other ideas of what are the types of things they're seeing for people who are gamers. And what my clients always want to know is, I want to know why video games are bad. Video games are bad because we, you know, after 2007, the idea of mirror neurons from Marco Iacoboni is now pretty well understood, that what you see, your mirror neurons, what you see is directly influencing your behavior, and that you are living as if it is you in the movie. So your brain is following along and empathizing. If you and I were having a conversation and one of us was upset, the other would be empathizing. We have mirror neurons. This is just a part of your prefrontal cortex. It allows you to be a social being. It allows you to follow along in life and know what's about to happen, or at least be able to predict what's happening. The bad news is that we really do probably have a greater chance of being violent and behaving in a way that you watch on television or on video games. That being said, there is less conclusive evidence that says playing a violent video game, like, say, a shooter game, has a predictability or the ability to say, if you play these games, you are going to engage in shooter behavior in our society. We have not seen that yet. What we have seen is mental illness increases chances of engaging in something like a violent video. So is there a reason to say video games are bad for us? Of course. Another side effect is they spend a lot of time playing a video game, and that's less time being up and moving. And one of the things we know is being outside helps to develop your dopaminergic systems in your frontal cortex. So the more we're outside, I think the guideline from Harvard is 2 hours a day outside moving seems to build your dopamine systems. Or on the other side of that is I have a significant amount of research that says video games increase your cognitive processing, and that there is a significant amount of beneficial change in your brain, and that playing video games increases, improves, and encourages neuroplasticity, not just of gamers, but of people who are over 50 years old, people who are over 65 years old, and that the gaming at an older age for our elderly builds and makes neural connections, and in particular, increases their visual processing. Now, the reason we care about visual processing is not just because speed of visual processing improves reading comprehension, but increasing visual processing allows you to drive.
So you're basically saying if you're a senior citizen, even, probably a good thing to play some video games.
Especially, and about 3 years ago, researchers came up with a game called NeuroRacer. And NeuroRacer, I believe you can still access free online at ARP.org, AARP.org. And which, yes, I am now receiving mail from ARP. It's a fun new phase, but ARP.org is going to have NeuroRacer. And after about 10 hours of playing NeuroRacer after 3 weeks, that people over the age of 55 increase their visual processing, and that improves their ability to drive. I also have research that says that playing shooter games, as horrible as that sounds to those of us who don't love video games, playing shooter games where you are looking for a target, so you're searching for a subject, usually the bad guy. So you're searching for your subject and you're going to be making aim for the subject, allows you to pick out a specific object. It increases and improves your ability to see.
I would think, as just somebody who watches movies and has played video games, that I would say video games even has definitely a step above movies, because you are having to use your brain and interact, and you're not just being fed information. Is that what the science supports?
Yeah, it is going to that. If I had to pick one of the two, I don't know which one I would pick. I would pick them as different. Because if you're going to be sitting in a movie, depending on who your cinematographer is and your director, they're going to have a different impact on your visual processing. So your movies are going to do things like set a state, teach you how to behave, increase your sensitivity toward. The other thing we know is a socially bonding movie. I don't know. What would we pick? Is that? I'm going to pick The Full Monty. I like The Full Monty as a socially bonding movie. That watching it increases progesterone levels. Well, increased progesterone levels increases altruism. It also improves relationships. In another study where marital couples were looking to get a divorce but agreed to counseling, half of them went for counseling. The other half agreed to watch 3 movies a week that they agreed had a social bonding theme. And at the end of their 6 weeks, the ones who went for marital counseling had showed almost no change in levels of satisfaction, whereas the ones who agreed to see 3 movies a week of a social bonding topic had a significant increase in their feelings of satisfaction.
That's probably way cheaper too than counseling. So
exactly. And it's much more tasteful, because going to counseling can lead to fights, arguments, and feeling badly about each other until the next counseling appointment. So I don't know that I can pick one over the other. But for example, in other games like real-time strategy games, what they know is the faster and the greater the gains are on your player, the faster the behavior the player behaves, they can get faster and faster and still decrease their errors and their mistakes. So it's possible to train the brain to learn faster, learn more quickly. And the reason that I hope everybody cares about this is because what a significant amount of evidence since 2009 is indicating is gamers learn faster domain.
Is there a tipping point or that science backs up that's basically like this much video game playing is too much and this much is okay?
That's just harder for me to answer specifically because it depends on all those factors I was saying. How old is the gamer? What is the game the gamer is playing? And what we're finding is largely inside of 10 days, you start to see changes in the brain. I think one of the things that I really liked was the idea that after about 10 hours of playing a spatial reasoning game, like, for example, Minecraft, the spatial reasoning differential between males and females disappears. So let me say it differently. Males underperform females in literacy in industrial countries, while females underperform a bit, but it's statistically significant, spatial reasoning with boys. Girls play video games for 10 to 20 hours. I have one that says 40 hours, but starting at 10 hours, there are changes in her gray matter, and the spatial reasoning gap all but disappears. And the implications for that is that, you know, as long as males are dominant in technology in this country, it would be okay for us to figure out how do we close those deficits. And research by Dr. Susan Levine is indicating video games and playing video games helps females to close that gap. And that's exactly what they're finding. I think the most important thing for us to do is understand the effect that video games have on your brain and your body. And if I were an educator or a parent trying to bring the idea of healthy video gaming or healthy Hollywood and movies, I would begin with my own research on just exactly what does happen in your body. Because when you sit and don't move, you're changing your chemistry. So your attention and focus. The other problem is what it does to attention in general. Attention is the key to our existence and quality of life. What you pay attention to dictates your life. And what we know about gamers is they have trained themselves to pay attention to the game while ignoring all distraction. So ironically enough, your gamer is more likely to have a problem with their focus and attention because the real world doesn't hold attention like a real-time game. But at the same time, gamers really do focus differently. They just have to be trained to pay attention in the circumstances where it's important. The military has been training people to pay attention for decades.
Is there a trick to training somebody to pay attention?
You can pay better attention by the end of the day today. Dr. John Kabat-Zinn in the 1970s began the idea and forwarded this whole idea of in the 70s was a shocking concept that today I think you can find across the United States. It's mindfulness. That we need to be mindful and that being mindful in your life is going to improve not just your ability to pay attention. Because what being mindful means is you and I are just listening to each other. You and I are focusing on this topic. What you and I are not thinking about is when we're done here, we have two other interviews or earlier this morning, I had a conversation and I wish I wouldn't have said that or take time out to kick myself for something I did wrong last week. That's an example of not being mindful. Well, what we know is research by Daniel Siegel out of UCLA says as soon as you do that, you're dividing your attention, you increase your norepinephrine, which is a stress chemical, which impairs your attention and focus, and you decrease your serotonin levels. So coming back to present, what neuroscientists have found, being mindful, being right here in present moment, lowers your stress, increases your serotonin, and improves your ability to focus your attention on the task at hand. So when I train my clients, I always try to bring them back to the idea that you have to pay attention to your life as if your life depends on it. And that's a John Kabat-Zinn idea, that paying attention to right here and right now is the fastest way to improve your quality of life. It also is going to develop and build your attention, which we now know is neural. Those neurons are busy connecting to one another. The more you pay attention to present. We also know that a side effect of paying attention, I mentioned earlier, is increasing working memory. But another is an improvement in your level of satisfaction in your relationships. Because paying attention to someone means you're listening to them and talking to them and not busy thinking about what's coming next or what argument you want to make or what you should have or you shouldn't have or being somewhere else compromises your relationships. And that there are researchers who spend time working with couples and couples therapy on just training in meditation. Right now, meditating outperforms couples counseling as well. When it comes to training our students, I'm going to defer to Navy SEALs. And when I see interviews by Navy SEALs, what I hear them say, back when they got Osama bin Laden, they were interviewing SEALs regularly, and they wanted to know what their number one go-to most important weapon was when it came to life and death. Without exception, they said, it's my mind game. They said, training myself to pay attention and stay in present moment allows me to think under pressure and do what I need to do. For a SEAL, paying attention to present moment might mean they have to stay in present moment for an hour or two, 12 hours or 14 hours until their moment arrives. And the way they train themselves is they focus their attention on their breathing, breathing in and breathing out. And that's all they focus on. So one does not need to wait for the weeks and weeks that a Navy SEAL would need to train their attention. You can begin immediately by starting the habit of whatever you're doing is where you are. At this moment, my present focus is right here, what we're doing.
Well, Kim, you are a wealth of knowledge, and I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. Are you ready for the pop quiz?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Pop quiz. Let's go.
If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
So this is going to be testing to what extent I'm a social studies teacher, right? I'd say, oh, everybody has to have social studies. If I had only one subject everyone was a part of, it's going to be a skill. It would be a hands-on topic. I don't care what you learn, but you have to make it and build it and create it. Because building and creating, it hijacks attention and focus, and it's extremely brain-friendly.
What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
We are not teaching in school that the 21st century doesn't really have answers. So I would be looking for students to find problems so that problem solving is much more natural than it is.
What does every child deserve?
A relationship with every single teacher.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
Being true to themselves and the reason they became a teacher or an educator in the first place. You did not become a teacher to do what the state required, to do what the Department of Education requires, or to do what the administration feels they're pressured into doing. Every teacher has got to remember why they became a teacher, and it is because they wanted to make a difference to a student. Having the courage to teach what they know the student will need for the rest of their life.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
Time.
And which teacher changed your life?
That'd be Mr. Ward. He was my 11th grade Western Civ teacher. And he was a teacher who believed that storytelling and telling about the interesting things that happened in history was the most important part of a boring curriculum. And he was silly and he giggled. And I remember him pulling his ears out to wiggle back and forth in front of the projector way back in the old days in front of the projector. He built a relationship with all of us because he was just fun. And he was telling stories about history the way it should be told, about the things that really are engaging and that matter. And I could never kick my fascination for learning after him.
And last question, pen or pencil?
Pencil.
All right. Again, Kim Bevel, we appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. If you want to catch up with her, you can head to her website at kimbevel.com. Or I guess you said you were on Facebook and Twitter. Is that right? Do you know your handle offhand?
No, I think it's just boring. It's just at Kim Bevel.
Well, that's easy. That's perfect.
Okay, well, there it is. Then I have a perfect one.
You want it to be nice and easy like that. Again, we appreciate you taking the time. That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and hit that subscribe button, and we'd also love it if you'd leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismiss. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortigo, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed!